there's one tool that I have proselytized for, it's Twitter. You had a whole door mural of people's tweets.
And on my wall, I had a quote from Sean Michael Morris, if you can't trust your students, you shouldn't be teaching.
Hashtag chats.
That doesn't encourage me. Welcome to another episode of Closing Tabs, the podcast of the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies at the University of Mary Washington. I'm your co-host, Chris Schaffer, and today I have with me my boss at Mary Washington slash executive director at Hybrid Pedagogy slash friend of several years, Jesse Stommel, to talk to us about teaching with social media. Welcome, Jesse.
Hi. It's nice to hang out with you, Chris.
Yeah, we should sit down and talk more often.
Yeah, I know. It'd be great if we could be in the same room together more often. not really.
Yeah. Well, of course, we have this glass wall in between our normal spaces, and you covered it with this like frosted thing, so we can't see each other.
Yeah, that's just because your energy is so powerful that I feel it through the glass. I don't actually need to see you. It would be a little bit overwhelming.
Oh, yeah, I get that sometimes. Well, let's dive right in. So teaching with social media, you have used Twitter a lot in class, blogs. Mary Washington is the home, I guess, or birthplace, for lack of a better term, of Domain of One's Own. So we have a lot of our students and faculty writing in public in a variety of ways with a variety of media. So what have you been doing with social media, and what aren't you doing anymore?
So I actually have long been, if there's one tool, I'm not much of a proselytizer, but if there's one tool that I have proselytized for, it's Twitter. I've done probably at least a half dozen teaching with Twitter workshops. I have led teaching with Twitter hashtag chats. I have taught a online course about teaching with Twitter. I have done all myriad of things to essentially proselytize for Twitter. For someone who's not usually a proselytizer, for someone who's a critical thinker about technology, it has been one of the few tools that I feel like I've kind of stood up on the mountaintop and said, hey, everyone, come use Twitter. In some ways, I did that because Twitter solved a problem for me. It solved a problem of the discussion forum in a learning management system. The discussion forum in a learning management system was, for me, a dead space, a space that conversation couldn't happen, agency couldn't be found. I had never really seen the kind of ecstatic, ephemeral, interactive, lively work that happens, for me, in a learning environment inside of the discussion forum tool in a learning management system. And so I searched for all kinds of different alternatives. And finally, I found what worked for me as an alternative, which was Twitter. And the reason that Twitter worked for me was because, and I say worked for me because I don't think it works equally well for everyone. It worked for me as a person, and it also worked in my classroom because it allowed for the kind of rapport, the kind of rat-a-tat-tat, the kind of back and forth that happens in human conversation, which I think is missing in discussion forums inside of a learning management system.
Yeah, and it's funny because you and I actually met on Twitter, and then we interacted in a variety of online forums before we ever met in person, maybe 2 or 3 years later, when you were visiting Colorado while I was there.
Well, and in fact, I think that the bulk of the people that we work with, almost every single one of them, I either engaged with them directly on Twitter or engaged with them via their Twitter profile before I met them in person. Lee Scaller at Bassett, the co-host of this wonderful podcast, is someone that I also knew on Twitter for years before I interacted with her in person. And she's kind of this larger-than-life person on Twitter. And so there was a way in which I even felt like I really felt like I knew her via that medium in a way that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, if I had just seen her at a conference. And I think the same thing for you. I feel like I knew you via not just the conversations we had, but also by witnessing how you worked in that space and also how you used the medium. I remember one of the things I noticed about you early on was the way you would take tweets from other people and print them out and put them on your wall. You had a whole door mural of people's tweets. Yep. And I was really honored to be on there. And what was really meaningful for me was not just that I was there, but it was the specific thing of mine that you had chosen to put on your door. And I can't actually remember it at this point, but I remember thinking that he sees me. And that's something that you don't get in many online spaces, the sense of really being seen, really being heard.
Yeah. And for me, I'm trying to remember, I can't remember the exact words of that tweet, but it was something to the effect of grading getting in the way of meaningful interactions with our students and really getting to know them as people and valuing them as people. And that one I printed off full size. Most of the tweets that I posted on my door were kind of like, you know, 1/8 of a typical page. And I did a bunch on one page, cut them up and put them around. But that one was really big front and center because it was both. I hear Jesse and Jesse has something important to say that I really value, but it was a message to my students. I had a lot of students coming into my office hours regularly, and I wanted them to see the value that I had and to see the kind of educators that I value and the kind of philosophies that I value. Let them know that even if I might be the only one articulating them in that environment at the time, there's a whole myriad of people outside the university that are connected and that are part of this project and believe in these things and support each other. But also to keep me honest too, like have this big message on my door saying, this is what I believe in. And on my wall, I had a quote from Sean Michael Morris. If you can't trust your students, you shouldn't be teaching. And I printed that out and put that up on my wall because I wanted my students to know, like, this is who I am. And this is how I want you to keep me accountable for being. And so like you, like Twitter's been very valuable in my past. I joke, I got my previous job because of my blog and my current job because of Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's only partially a joke that work in public, the interactions with people, the networking that it led to, the scholarship that was built there and performed there were really valuable in my past and continue to have value for me.
I would say I would actually go as far to say that I have gotten every single one of my full-time academic jobs because of Twitter. And even if it wasn't because people knew me on Twitter, because something I had done on Twitter or something I had accomplished on Twitter, the reason I would say it is because Twitter is the space that I think allowed me to most fully realize who I was in academia and who I was going to be in education. Because when I started using Twitter really heavily, I actually signed up for Twitter right when it came out, late 2006, early 2007, and didn't really use it for about 3.5 years, I think. And that's how I usually am with a lot of spaces. I sign up for them, and then I'm a lurker for years before I kind of figure out what I'm going to do in them. And the point that I figured out what I wanted to do on Twitter was right when I graduated with my PhD from CU Boulder. And in some ways, my experience at CU Boulder was great, but I also experienced what a lot of graduate students continue to feel, is a kind of pressure to be something they're not, a pressure to conform to a particular system, a pressure to exist in a particular discipline, to cut their life up into particular containers. And I resisted that, but I didn't really find a space where I could fully occupy and fully be myself as an educator and academic until I started using Twitter. And it was in part because I found pockets all over the world of people that were similar to me. And it allowed me to kind of feel seen for the first time. Because at my graduate institution, there weren't people who higher education pedagogy was their primary research interest. There isn't multiple people at very many institutions, anywhere where higher education pedagogy is their primary research interest.
Right, and I find the same thing. My first job where I had taken my Twitter private, I had pulled down some blog posts and things. I was operating under that, keep things quiet method while I was on the job market, because I was applying to anything that I could remotely qualify for. And during that process, looking back, that was a very limited way to do it, but it was the way I knew at the time. And so that first job for me, that didn't have an impact on it. And then when I got that job, it was in a place where I was the only one in my discipline in really the region, that part of the state. There wasn't even a PhD granting institution in the state of South Carolina with a music theory PhD. So this is the way I connected to other musicians, particularly other music theorists and educators. And then that's what drew me into the pedagogy community, not even just higher ed, but connecting with high school or high school teachers and middle school teachers and the like. And it was really liberating. And so I brought that to my students, right? And I know you have as well. And I've even used some of your work to bring it to my students as a way for them to find those other people. And as you say, to be seen in a world that's very compartmentalized, and where who we are as educators, who we are as scholars, as people, often in some cases isolates, but in some cases just we're really unique, and we all are in different ways. And the web has allowed us to find those other communities.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's not necessarily just about finding other people like us, but it's also about being able to sit inside of conversations we wouldn't otherwise be able to be in. So, for example, I feel like in some ways Twitter is still my lifeline to the K-12 community, who I feel like is having such rich conversations that have such a big influence on everything that I do. And I don't, like, there are other ways for me to access that community, but in some ways, Twitter keeps that community brushing up against me and my work every single day. And there's a bunch of other communities who I feel like Twitter is the place where we all cross each other's path. It's the kind of bumping, that kind of ephemeral, casual bumping into people in the hallways that I feel like is sometimes so necessary for our work.
Right. So that visibility, though, that connectedness to a much broader world, that comes with a downside, right? And we've seen a lot more of that in the last, say, 3 years than we did when we first started using Twitter as scholars and as teachers and inviting our students to interact online. And even outside of Twitter, this, you know, harassment and abuse and disinformation and all kinds of things that we could be leading our students into if we aren't really careful are still out there and have implications for programs like Domain of One's Own at Mary Washington. So you're not still using Twitter in class, right?
No. Well, and actually, I will say that I haven't used Twitter actively in my teaching, aside from the fact that many of my students are on Twitter. And so the work that we're doing in class bleeds over into Twitter, of course. But it hasn't been a formal part of my classes since, I want to say, about 2014. And I didn't, when I stopped using Twitter in my classes, it wasn't as deliberate as my decision is now to continue not using it. At first, it just didn't fit. There was something that wasn't quite right. There was a way in which it just didn't line up with what I was doing in the class. And interestingly, as recently as I think 2015, I taught an online course. As recently as 2015, I taught an online course about teaching with Twitter. The weird thing is I hadn't taught with Twitter for a year and a half. A lot of that conversation became about how do we make the critical choices that keep people safe in the environment. I also, as recently as 2015, was actually working on a book about Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know that I was working on this. Yeah. I was working on it, and I'll now tell people what the book is because I don't think I plan to ever release this book. interestingly, I had done all the writing for the book. Because the book was going to be a series of my tweets. And the idea was to do a 140-page book with a single tweet on every page of the book and then use graphic design to kind of string those tweets together. And the book was going to be called, and now someone is probably going to steal this idea. It's like, okay, I'm copywriting it right now, even though I'm never going to write it. You can't have this.
Copyright ideas. Only expressions.
So the title of the book was going to be The Elements of Twitter Style. And it was essentially going to be about the creative constraint, the creativity that can happen within constraint. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily just going to be about Twitter, but it was going to be about how constraint allows us to occupy it in different creative ways, which is something that Twitter has. I don't know that Twitter helped me figure it out, but it's some Twitter helped me crystallize my thinking about this idea of improvising within a frame or creative constraint. I'm not working on that book, nor do I have any plans to work on that book. And in part, it's because I just don't, I can't imagine centering any long period of my life around a medium that is becoming increasingly hostile to the kinds of work that I want to do in the world. And the weird conundrum is that I still use Twitter as a space to do that work, and I probably still plan to use Twitter as a space to do that work, but I don't feel like I can actually advocate, proselytize, champion Twitter in the way that I could before. In some ways, I remain on the medium myself as a way to continue to occupy space that I see as being threatened.
Yeah, and I'm much the same way. I think the last time I required a Twitter account for students would be 2013, and 2014 was probably the last time we had a significant Twittery assignment type, you know, typically the Twitter essay that you wrote about in your article. And I found so much value in that kind of short form writing. Students over the course of a semester or two of doing those got so good at manipulating down to the single character the statement that they wanted to make, and were making such creative statements, in this case about music and musical structure, and even mirroring the musical structure in the tweets. And there's still examples of some of my best student work include these mm-hmm. tweets.
And I'd say, just to fill in, I'd say that assignment, the Twitter essay, has been one of my most read posts, most read articles I've ever written. And it also, in some ways, I would say, is the most successful assignment that I ever created, for various different reasons, some of which you're talking about right now.
Yeah. And so that was such a great forum for writing, and it helped their writing in other ways. They got more concise and more clear in just writing thesis statements for academic papers, in writing hooks for blog posts. And so there's a lot of value in it. And yet, because of the environment and because of the company's responses and non-responses to the problems of disinformation and harassment and abuse on their platform, much of which I've studied as a researcher now, but some of it I experienced firsthand as a target, mm-hmm. Smaller scale target than some, so I don't want to minimize what other people have gone through, but I can't in good conscience subject my students to that or introduce them to yeah. that in the class. So we're doing different things now, and I know you're doing some different things.
Can I ask you really quick before we talk? Yeah. I want to talk about some of those new things that we're experimenting with, but can you say a little bit more about like what it is that has changed with Twitter? What it is that has made Twitter for you a space that is hostile to your pedagogies? Would you use the word hostile?
Potentially hostile, yeah. So I think part of the problem for me is that as a straight white male, I don't get targeted to the extent that mm-hmm. a lot of my students would, especially at Mary Washington, where a large majority of our students are female. We have students who were not born in the U.S., students of color, students of a variety of gender and sexuality identities. Like these are people who are more likely to be targeted than I am. That targeting could come from bots that are meant to overwhelm and silence. It could come from real people making threats. And while I haven't had that happen directly to any of my students yet, I have had students receive, spammy blog comments that were just a little much for them to deal with right out of the bat when yeah. they started working in public.
Especially if
I were to amplify via my account yeah. right now their writings, the kinds of people that have their eye on me because of the work I've done exposing disinformation campaigns and botnets mm-hmm. could potentially subject them to
yeah.
those negative people in my world. And if I can't amplify them on social media, a lot of the value of them working in social media is lost because they don't have that connection to a wider network.
Yeah.
I
think that's something that really happened for me is the when I lost the ability to just hit the retweet button and benevolently amplify someone's voice. Because to me, that was one of the big powers for me of Twitter, was that I could hit that retweet button and it wouldn't be my face up there. It would be the person, their originally words, amplified to a different community. And there was a real power in that, sort of spreading people's ideas to communities that they might not otherwise reach. And when I stopped being able to do that safely for those people, it really started to change. And so to me, that's partly about scale and the changing scale of how what has happened for me personally on Twitter, and probably for you as well. But I don't think it's just scale. I think that it also has to do with the way that Twitter is handling the algorithms. It means that sometimes things are amplified more than they should be, more than they can safely be. Because the algorithm doesn't know, it doesn't make critical choices about when to amplify and when not to amplify, like you and I would.
Right.
It also, there's also a sense in which you can't shut down the amplification in quite the same way that you once could. For example, being able to just unretweet something.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't necessarily, I mean, there was a point at which I felt like I could retweet something, and if I saw it kind of going into a community that was going to be hostile to it, I could unretweet it, and that would actually feel like it had an impact. I feel in some ways, and I don't quite understand it, but that's what Twitter is trying to do, have me not quite understand how their algorithm works. So that in some ways, it's like a lure, like it's a mysterious power that we can have.
Right. Well, and you know, one problem that compounds that is we can't even just click like to let our student know really easily, hey, we saw that and we value that, because that alone, it used to be a silent signal and now it's an algorithmic driver.
Yeah.
But this is one of the problems with modern AI, machine learning, algorithmically generated content, is that everyone's using the same fundamental data science. They're trying to give it an air of mystery so that they can be essentially wizards, magicians that that have access to something that no one else does. This the secret sauce, the secret recipe. They're using the same deep learning techniques, the same machine learning techniques as everyone else, the same predictive analytics. And if they expose that, it would be, it wouldn't have the same magic, right? And they wouldn't necessarily get the same buy-in. And I know as someone working more and more in data science, the necessity of having the appeal of magic when you're trying to market your work, when you're trying to, whether it's getting a consulting gig or selling a product, you want an air of mystery. You want to be able to say, like Apple does with their products, it's revolutionary and it's magical, even if it's just an incremental gain that adds a very real new use case that's a value for people.
Yeah.
That just doesn't have the same flair to it.
Yeah.
And so I understand the need for that, but on the other side, when they hide the algorithm, when they don't, when they limit what you can do with the API as an independent researcher, when they are not forthright with the U.S. House and Senate investigations and potentially law enforcement, when they don't let white hat hackers into their database to even just tell them what kind of problems they're finding, we're left in a position where we can only trust Twitter about what's going on Twitter. Well, that could be good marketing when it comes to bad actors and trying to expose them and shield ourselves from them and or protect our students from them, create a safe space there for them to play and to work. That ends up being a form of gaslighting where Twitter discounts all experts and says, just trust us.
So we've been talking about social media, but we're really focused on Twitter so far. Are there other social media that you've used in the past that have been successful? And I'll maybe answer this, I'll answer the question first, but and why have they been successful? And is there a way in which they're becoming increasingly broken as well? And I will start by saying that I didn't use Facebook for teaching for the longest time. I have never liked the algorithm, sort of this, I don't know, the bizarre feeling of having Facebook serve up content to me. I feel that even more on Facebook than I do on Twitter, because in some ways Twitter tries to not even let you, like people could probably say, oh wait, Twitter's algorithmic now, even though it's been algorithmic for years now. Facebook, I've never been a fan of. However, I've had some success with teaching inside of Facebook groups. In some ways, because they create this little segment of Facebook that's almost separate or distinct from the rest of Facebook. So in some ways, it's like a classroom. It's taking someone from the world, bringing them into a classroom, and they've got this space where they can work. It's still connected to the rest of the world, connected to the rest of their digital life on Facebook, but it is a separate room. On the other hand, I personally am not using Facebook anymore, so it's not a world that I live in. So it's an artificial thing if I were to continue using it for teaching. Another tool I've used is Medium, and my problem with, I've had huge success with Medium, in part because I like the way that it allows you to create a blog network. It reminds, it's almost, I have a nostalgic attachment to blog rings, because in the 90s when I was using the web, what I loved were blog rings. Two things I loved. Before blog rings, it was AOL chat rooms. And then it was blog rings, and Medium felt like a blog ring. And there's not much else like Medium that feels like a blog ring. And
even that has changed. Yep. I mean, the way that they're serving up content to users when they come to the site, that doesn't have that same kind of serendipitous quasi-social discovery of information. It's just much more corporately crafted.
I used Medium for a year, and even, you know, I started to proselytize a little bit about Medium. Stopped really quickly when I found out what their monetization strategy was, and that their monetization strategy was exactly as you said, driven towards hierarchizing content, basically privileging some content over others. You know, it's like all of these companies like Medium are, you know, fighting for net neutrality, but they're building a system within themselves that does not resemble at all the net neutrality they're supposedly fighting for.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I even tried Google Plus once. It turned into largely an assignment scheduling notification system that was tied to Google Drive, where we had stored a lot of content. I haven't ever used Facebook in class, but I've used Hypothesis. We use Slack a lot here at Mary Washington, a lot of the digital studies and computer science courses. Slack is wonderful. I love that. It's not quite social media per se, but it has a little bit of that 90s, you know, quasi-private or completely private chat feel to it.
I think it feels a lot like an AOL chat room.
Yeah, and
a series of linked AOL chat rooms, which is actually how AOL chat rooms kind of worked. They were kind of stacked upon one another, and you'd maybe have multiple chat windows open at a single time. It could be kind of bouncing back and forth between them. It actually, in some ways, I think that Slack is allowing me to have the kind of exchanges that I would have had on Twitter 5 years ago. Yeah. But allowing them to be, again, just slightly sectioned off from the rest of the, they feel connected to other things, but they don't necessarily feel like as permeable to abuse or misinformation as Twitter is feeling.
Right. And we as faculty can take the responsibility to moderate if we think that actually needs to be done in that setting, which is something we couldn't do on a social media platform. It also has some nice links out to other things on the web. It does it in a pretty seamless way that allows most things to be, you know, viewed or, you know, listened to or whatever inside Slack.
Unlike the discussion forums in a learning management systems, learning management system, which fail to be a portal to the rest of the web. The problem isn't that one of the problems is that a learning management system looks nothing like the rest of the web. But the other and perhaps bigger problem is that it doesn't really function as a very good portal to the rest of the web either. And whereas I think Slack is, that's exactly not true. It is a separate environment, feels like a separate environment, feels like it's separate from the rest of the web, but it also feels like it's connected.
Yeah, and I think that connection is really important, especially with domain of one's own. We have a really easy way for our students to create content online and to read each other's work and engage with the public. We live in an era where publishing it online and maybe doing a little SEO and doing some link sharing won't really get you that big audience. You have to go through some social network or some other thing to get people to your site and to interact with people. And that's where I think within the class environment, something like Slack or something hypothesis can be really beneficial, because it's a link between, it's a portal between these things. The LMS just can't be the place where they write for a public audience or even a small audience like the class organically and discuss organically, but also like we need a place to link what we're doing to the rest of the internet, even when we're on domains. I've tried some of the indie web protocols. None of them quite hit the mark for me. And so there was always some sort of social media engagement to try to link domains together. And that's something I'm still working out. But for now, I think it with my research in disinformation and what I've seen with abuse and harassment on so many of these places online, right now I'm trying to create a space for my students to practice the kind of work they would do in public before it is fully public, and get feedback from each other, share things with each other, play with the technologies before people get to them and see it and start linking to it, so that then they can start to think about what of that work they want to curate on their public domain, what they really want to highlight and draw attention to, what they're comfortable sharing widely now that it's kind of been through the ringer a little bit.
I also think that, like, increasingly, I don't like this idea of, in my pedagogy, of students turning in assignments to me as though all roads right. lead back to me as the teacher. I think we're also talking this is relevant to this distinction between social media and domain of one's own, that in a sense, if we make social media, especially a corporate platform like Twitter or even Slack to some degree, and I want to ask the question about what, like, is there anything in Slack that makes us slightly nervous? But if we make a space like Twitter the hub for the class, it means that students have to leave their space and come to the hub. It's sort of like turning an assignment. Mm-hmm. All roads in that case don't lead back to me as the teacher. All roads in that case lead back to a corporation. But instead, if we can think about students as building these their own spaces on the web, and that we come to visit them on their own turf, in their own environment that they've built, and then we encourage them to visit each other, it has a very, very different feeling and allows them to own the space in a way that they wouldn't otherwise be able to.
Right. It's this hub and spoke model we've talked about in a lot of contexts here at UMW, where there's routes out from the main hub to other places. We're not aggregating all of the students' content onto the faculty members' page, where everyone goes to the faculty members' domain instead of the students' domain. Yeah. And we're not talking about everyone doing their work completely in an LMS or completely even within Slack. But there's this back and forth between this communal space that we share and, you know, be honest, like at some level, you know, even domain of one's own, you know, no matter how indie we go, we're always in a corporate platform at some point. But having this corporate platform, whether it's Slack or the LMS, as the place where we work together, and then also having our own places and mm-hmm. using the hub as the way to collaborate and bounce ideas off each other, but also the way to find people and lead each other to our own spaces and then encourage more links to be built.
It reminds me of our open office plan currently, where we have desks around the outside of the room that people work independently at, and then they can turn to the middle of the room, and any point they can move back and forth.
And I want to draw another analogy with that too, because we used to have everybody's desks in the middle at that big table with these barriers in between, and the idea was collaboration because we're all close together and we're all looking at each other. But what we found is that it was really hard to sit next to each other because we had some barriers there. Taking those barriers out meant we didn't have drawers to put our stuff away in, right? And then when we actually wanted to collaborate, we'd have to walk all the way around all of the desks to get to somebody. So what it promoted was chit-chat and not collaboration.
Yeah.
And now we have more furniture in the room, but more space because we've separated out individual stations and kept a collaborative space in the middle.
And also creates a sense in which you need more than one space. You don't just need one home for a class.
Right.
All roads should never lead to anywhere. All roads should lead to all kinds of different places when we're talking about a learning environment. So is there anything about Slack that makes you antsy? Are there any concerns you have? It is a corporate platform. It is monetized. Honestly, its monetization strategy is the monetization strategy strategy I like that I'm the least nervous about, which is a freemium model, where they offer its basic functionality to every single user for free. Mm-hmm. And then they charge, usually large businesses or corporations, you know, we pay for a paid instance of Slack for DTLT, but we also use free instances in our courses.
And they seem to have a pricing model that, to my understanding, I haven't done deep research, but it seems to be sustainable, where some companies with a freemium model, it's not. And they're going to have to cash in on their free users' data at some point.
Exactly. And so I, even though they are collecting my data, I don't, it doesn't seem like there's a pathway towards that as their monetization strategy. Although still sometimes you worry. They're gathering, especially when you get to having a paid account, they're collecting and archiving, unless you tell them not to, every interaction forever. That's a lot.
Yeah, and you know, as a data scientist, that gets me excited about the cool things you could do with all that data. I have a friend who works at Stack Overflow as a data scientist, and she gets to look at all of the posts and questions and answers and, you know, pluses and minuses and thumbs up and down on that platform to find really cool trends about how the software development world is moving. And Slack is going to be able to do that with that data if they're careful in how they do that. But that's the one thing that worries me, is any online communication that's not end-to-end encrypted starts to worry me. So I've started thinking, should I have my students sign up for Keybase? You know, which still is like, it's not quite there, though it's much better in terms of encryption.
So are there any other tools that you're, and I'm going to talk about one that I actually am not a huge fan of, although I want to give it another chance. Are there tools that have just come out that you haven't really used yet that you're curious about? So the one I'm going to talk about is Mastodon. And a lot of people have been encouraging me to use Mastodon. I've actually been on Mastodon since it came out, like I do with almost every social media. Sign up for an account, kind of let it sit fallow until I figure out what or if I want to use it, how I want to use it, or if I want to use it. My issue with Mastodon is, even though I like the idea that it creates these individual instances, it's sort of like if Slack and Twitter had a baby. You could create these little instincts. You create these
that doesn't encourage me.
Yeah. You create these little instances of a Twitter-like experience that are independent. And the issue for me is that we have 10 years of evidence that Twitter was really good at some things but really failed at others. And I don't feel like Mastodon has set itself apart from Twitter enough. On the other hand, when I said that publicly, someone from Mastodon jumped in and gave me an article that showed all of the different ways that Mastodon is different from Twitter. But to me, it's the basic architecture. The thing I love about Twitter, the constraint, the 140 characters, the at sign, the hashtag, a lot of those things were created by users of Twitter. In some ways, I think a lot of those things that were the amazing blessing of Twitter have also proved to be some of the pieces that are problematic. There's something about Twitter,
any platform,
that allows there to be a swarm of an attack to develop into a swarm. And a swarm that is beyond comprehension in its size, beyond our ability to really even grapple with it, fathom it. If it happens to you, it has happened to you. It's also happened to me. Honestly, it's happened to me a couple times. It's happened to you once, as far as I know. I know people it's happened to hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. When I try and describe what happened to me to people who it's never happened to, they don't understand. They almost even dismiss it as, oh, don't worry, you can just ignore it, is what they'll say. And I'm like, do you understand like what this actually looks and feels like? And for some of us, so much of our lives are in our phone. And if that phone is vibrating so much that it is knocked off the table by the attack that's underway against us, it's not something you just can say, just don't bother with that. And so what I worry is that something like Mastodon hasn't thought critically enough about what the successes and failures of Twitter were.
Yeah, and for me, there's this other strain in my mind here, which is the psychological and productivity impact of social media. Like, there's been so many benefits, but it's gotten to the point where those benefits aren't outweighed by the downsides of the constant notifications and the, you know, the addiction directed product design, that just taking that open source and making it indie or making it smaller scale is not going to solve the problems of the affordances of the platform, not only line up with the affordances of harassment and abuse campaign desires, but they're also the kinds of things that make it really easy for us to lose control of our psyche to an extent. And that's something that anytime someone brings up Mastodon to me, it's like, I'm not in the market for another social media network. I've done that, and you know, it's a place of privilege to be able to say it, I know, but like I don't want to have that anymore. I'm trying to figure out how to work without it in my own life. I definitely don't want to require my students to do it, or just test out new ways to do the same kinds of things.
And honestly, I'm not a person who's going to quit social media at any time soon. I did back away from Facebook. I didn't, in a blaze of glory, cancel my account. I just don't use it. Twitter, I use a lot less than I used to use. I'm unlikely to quit Twitter just because there are connections that I have that, and this scares me about Twitter, because in some ways I feel like I'm held hostage by a corporation who knows that some of my closest, dearest relationships, professional relationships in particular, exist inside of that platform. And it's not that they're non-transferable. It's just that there's no real clear pathway for transfer of those relationships.
And I feel like that's both a reason to stay and a reason why we never should have been there in the first place, because we built those relationships in that environment, not knowing what would happen, not knowing the changes Twitter would make, because it's not like we joined Twitter and we should have had our eyes open, because the terms have changed, the API has changed, the platform has changed, tons of things have changed. But the fact that our relationships are invested in something that is itself problematic
and not owned by us,
so
I guess for me what I'm excited for is, probably this won't happen for 3 to 5 years, I hope it happens in 3 to 5 years, someone will look at all of these things and say, I'm going to start over from scratch and build something, because I need to communicate via technology. And so I need communication tools. Mm-hmm. Right now, I don't feel like I have a good one. I feel like I have a bunch of ones that don't quite do what I need them to. And I cobble together a life, a digital life, by stringing them together. I hope that someone looks and learns from the successes and the mistakes of some of these platforms, but really starts from scratch and says, what can the internet be? And I, like, in the wake of net neutrality, in the wake of Donald Trump, in the wake of misinformation, disinformation campaigns, I don't know what the internet can be, but I hope that it's something good.
Yeah. Well, so what excites me right now is these platforms that are making end-to-end encryption actually accessible. So I've just started to play around with Keybase, using that in a couple contexts. I realized at one point that as I was conversing via DM with someone on Twitter about the possibility that my data had been leaked by Twitter to somebody I didn't want it to have. Turns out that probably wasn't the case. I was like, maybe I shouldn't be having this conversation in a Twitter DM. And so something like Keybase, where it's, you don't have to mess with the keys, but you have encryption keys and you have abilities to connect with people on multiple devices in ways that can really secure those conversations, and that they're trying to make it, in some ways it seems kind of Slack-like in the way it works. Like that's encouraging to me. Things like Open Whisper Systems has Signal, great text messaging platform that can do end-to-end encryption, but can also just have regular text with people who don't have that has some protection from your ISP or from your phone service provider. Things like ProtonMail and Tutanota, all these end-to-end encrypted email services where the people creating the service don't own the key. Password managers like LastPass and 1Pass and things like that can help people be more secure in their use of these online tools, so that if one gets hacked, the others don't. And I'm just really hoping, and I think this is the direction that somebody is moving, is towards something that has a lot of the affordances we've talked about with Slack and some of the benefits of Twitter in terms of these like quasi-public communities, but allows for encrypted communications to keep our data away from the government and away from corporations that we wouldn't want to have it or people we wouldn't want to have it, but also allows some openness and some ability to find each other in serendipitous ways and to share things and link out to the web, not just like I'm sending a secret message, so we have to have this carrier pigeon that can't do anything but bring secret messages, but can actually link out to the web in ways that are safe. I think that that's where things are going to go in the next few years, and the tools are starting to pop up and have mobile and desktop versions, and so I'm excited about that, and I hope that that develops further, because that's the piece that's been missing, bringing the safety to the serendipity.
And I think like I want the internet to feel playful again. Yeah. I want the internet to feel fun. I want the internet to feel joyous. Mm-hmm. And you know, we could say, well, nothing's going to feel fun and playful if you're worrying about encryption keys and you're, you know, like worried about what's going to happen to your data and stuff like that. Like in some ways this conversation is sucking some of the fun out of the internet, but I don't think it is. It could be seen that way, but I actually think if we can create spaces that have a relative amount of safety, that then you can play, then you can experiment, then you can take risks. But until we feel a certain amount of safety, which I don't feel currently, I don't think we have a good platform for doing that.
Right. I mean, we sleep better at night because we have locks on our doors and windows, right? And so some degree of protection, of fencing, ends up giving us more freedom. Like, I feel like that's where we need to move. The Wild West of everybody has a ranch with a well and no fence. Like we're past the point of the internet being that and having it be safe and productive and playful. It just can't be. It's too dangerous. Yep. But by erecting just the right fence, I think we can create a space that's safe enough that we can put up a swing set in the sandbox again.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Fun. Yeah. Well, that was fun. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll share some links to the things we talked about on the website. So as you listen, come to umwdtlt.com to dive deeper into some of these issues and play around with some of these tools in a safe environment. And happy teaching online.
See you later.
DongleCast.